All right, and I think we're live. Hey guys, what's going on? Taxation is theft. I'm getting a little bit of a late start today with some technical issues, but I would like to welcome Mike Shipley.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. So, Mike is one of the founders of the Libertarian Socialist Caucus. He's also involved in a few other caucuses. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because I'll mess it up.
Sure. So I'm one of the founders of the Libertarian Socialist Caucus. I'm also the founder, one of the founders of the Paupertarian Caucus, and I'm one of the founders of the Libertarian Party Audacious Caucus. I'm also currently treasurer of Outright Libertarians. And there's a whole collection of other projects I could, go on and name. Right now, one of the most exciting is the push for bottom unity, and that's what I'm here to talk about today.
Cool, awesome. So, before we get into that, because I know that that'll take up all of our time. And actually, I'm gonna turn my feed off to you, so you're not gonna see me, and see if that helps some of these technical issues over here. But before we get into the bottom unity, let's talk about your involvement with the Sarwark campaign, because that's actually a pretty campaign that's going on there in Phoenix, right?
Yes, I'm really excited about it.
So what does it look like out there? Who's he running against? Are you getting good responses from people?
So we've been walking neighborhoods every night for the past couple of weeks. What's going on in Phoenix is that the former mayor has resigned so that he can run for Congress. He's not allowed to continue holding the mayor. Position as like, once he's running, he can't. I don't know if it's a state law or what it is, but he has to, give up the seat. So he
Okay.
has done that, and we are now holding a special election. He's being Nick Sarwark is being challenged by Kate Gallego, who is an establishment Democrat. She's been in the state legislature for a long time. Wait, I think she might actually have been a city council person for a long time. To be honest, I don't keep track of all the status and all their different things because they're,
Yeah. Why do that?
right? Like they, I don't know. They're just like she's one of them, right? And the other guy's name is Danny Valenzuela. He's definitely an establishment Democrat as well. I know he's got a political background as well. Another one of them. So, Nick is, we've been getting a really good reception. A lot of people are pretty much fed up with the status quo from top to bottom, So when I knock on the door, typically they find out it is a bipartisan race. A lot of people do want to know what party he's registered in. And when I tell them, a lot of times they get really excited to sign because they're excited to sign for something outside of what they've been getting.
Right. Well, that's awesome. Because I know it's, yeah, it's there's always mixed feelings with that. Some people are excited to get someone that's not in the two parties, and then some people are just they get weird about like why are you doing this? It's so that's good to hear. You're mostly getting positive feedback on that. So cool. So let's talk about bottom unity. I know did you watch the interview I had with Dane maybe a week ago?
I did. I caught the first half and then I missed some and then I caught the end of it. So,
Okay, so
I caught most of it. Yeah.
okay, cool. So yeah, so we were talking a lot about this, and obviously there's a lot of questions, and there's so I'm more, most of the people I associate with are more of the ANCAP side. So I guess the lower, what would that be? The bottom right.
Bottom right, yes.
And so one of the things that they're concerned about, and I tried to push Dane on this, and I think he gave me, really good responses. Like, he didn't make me feel like he's going to come for my property. All these other things. He sounded like more or less his ideal lifestyle is perfectly compatible with that of the bottom right. But in talking to some other people in the I guess the Libertarian Socialist Caucus, it sounds like they're more they're not out to steal, but the way that they view property rights is the things that they want to do is not considered stealing to them, but to a bottom right might be considered. And we'll get into that into a minute. But one of the things that you mentioned to me is not so much, bringing up this fight in between us, but that, we're not trying to fight what our differences are, but we're actually just trying to unify because there are so many similarities that we can help each other out in, basically getting rid of big government, because that's kind of the big thing that's in both of our ways. So
Right.
what's your take on that?
Okay, so I do think there's a lot of common ground. Everyone wants to end the drug war. Everyone wants to end US imperialism and, stop murdering people all over the globe. Everyone wants to scale back, if not abolish, the prison state, the police state. So I think there's a lot to work with just with that. I
Absolutely.
would kind of dig a little deeper into the idea that if somebody identifies as an anarchist, then by definition, they want to abolish all of the same controls over property that left libertarians are saying we want to abolish. So, for a left libertarian in our semantics, the phrase private property isn't referring to principles of ownership or possession. It's referring to the legal constructs, for instance, the title, the land authority, the idea that you have to get permission from the county assessor to decide where the border of your land is. All of those things, the statist controls over what counts as property and whose property gets protected, is the thing that's in question. And I think that we don't have to. It's not even forced. Like, we are in 100% agreement with anarcho-capitalists on the fact that that needs to be abolished.
So, I guess the way I've always kind of seen, like a county assessor is something that could be replaced with maybe a private organization, but basically, you've got different people on different plots of land, and if there's ever, if there's ever a dispute, then you have some place that you can go to and say, okay, I want this piece of land to be mine, and I want to build a home on it. So I'm going to go to this, a public registry, and it can be whatever. It doesn't have to be government, but I'm just going to write down that this is my land. And in that way, if there's anybody else who thinks like, maybe that's their land and they were away the day that I found it, then we could see immediately that, oh, somebody else already claims that land is theirs, or we can at least bring up that discussion, and whether or not the state's laws are in place are valid to settle that dispute is another question. But at least there would be some sort of, oh, well, we can figure out if there is some other person. I guess kind of the way it works with internet domain names, but maybe that's a bad example because there's a central authority on that you have to, purchase the original from. But I guess where I'm going with that is I kind of see some validity in some type of system with that. What would be the bottom left's solution to that? So I guess my solution would be, get the government out of it and replace it with some sort of public registry that anyone can go to, or anyone can create their own registry to compete with, kind of like how maybe a credit bureau is a good a private analogy to that type of thing.
So, what I hear you saying is that the statist form of that registry and its controls is unjust. Am I hearing you correctly? It's a source of injustice that is distorting property relations between people.
Yeah, I would say so to some degree. It's probably less than most of their other organizations, but yeah.
So it needs to go away because all of the things associated with it are bad. And what needs to replace it needs to look very different in order for the replacement to actually fulfill the promise of a world set free that is no longer under the things we associate with statism in today's market. Is that right?
Well, are we talking about the just the...
Sure, because all you did to what I heard is that you suggested replacing the justice monopoly with independent justice processes that aren't linked to state power.
Oh, well, I guess I wasn't talking about the justice in that part. I'm really just talking about, like, having a registry, having a place where, you know...
Well, but you can go... No, because you said dispute resolution. That's right. What that is. That's justice.
Right. That's kind of the other side of that. So, yeah, you know, so let's say all the, you know, the government's courts go away and we have some other way to resolve that.
Right.
To resolve any disputes.
So what we would have, what we get to do together as anarchists is teach a bunch of people that they don't need to rely on the state, and then allow them to decide together what they want to replace it with, right? And we all know that humans like to dispute things, and that the demand for a dispute resolution process of some type will not go away, right? So what we can say is that processes can replace it that can look more like justice, less like statism and its abuses, and that would be a good thing, right? And you're asking me what they look like. I'm partly kind of trying to craft for you a space where what I think that should look like does not become prescriptive, right? Because we want to avoid the temptation of central planning. I can't central plan anarchism for you, and you can't plan it for me. And if either of us tries to say that we can, then I would be skeptical of that person's commitment to an actual world set free. So the first thing to say is that I'm not going to tell you what I think it should look like so much as I'm telling you what I believe it can look like. And if we educate people about the different ways that it's possible to think about property in a world set free, absent the land monopoly, then we give them the tools to have a collaborative discussion and decide what those justice systems might look like.
Okay, so I guess that's a fair way to put it. I think, you know, there's kind of, I guess in what you say, there's almost a sense of democracy forming there where you say, like, we as individuals would have to decide a system, and ultimately it's, you know, that leads to, like, what we have now where different people want different things, and of course the majority is going to try and use their weight, which I think is something that neither one of us want, because I think we both agree that, you know, a majority ruling over a minority is still tyranny.
Okay, so there's some nuance there. I would not say democracy, because that implies a system, a closed system where majority can dominate the minority. I would say animated by a democratic spirit. And by that, I mean that the people who choose to associate for a particular purpose then are able to utilize consensus process among themselves. But the freedom from tyranny is contained in the freedom of association, that nobody is ever compelled to associate with a particular set of people that are, you know, making a particular democratic decision. So let's say, for example, like a great example is an HOA, a homeowners association. Those are well known to be incredibly abusive and usually not maybe physically, but like to like the harassment point of like literally measuring your grass and like charging your money and threatening to evict, right? Those don't work. They purport to be democratic in spirit. There's a homeowners association. You can go to the meeting. You can sit on the board if you really want to suffer. But you can't actually like withdraw from the HOA, because you're locked into it, to that tyranny that you say of the majority, right? So freedom of association and consensus process have to go together, because without the freedom to exit a tyrannizing majority decision, you don't actually have the consent. The fundamental concept of consent is like primary. Right? Libertarianism is consent culture. It's centering the autonomy and the self-determination of the individual. And without that, you don't, you can't, I don't know anyway, though. So that's the nuance behind democracy as a system, bad. Democratic as a way of making decisions, not so bad.
So I guess let's go back to a concrete example, because I think that's, you know, that's kind of where the rubber hits the road and where we can see, you know, what, as you say, what it could look like. So, you know, let's say, for example, if we're talking about like a place where property would be registered, and you know, measured and registered and says, and, you know, or sorry, let's not talk about a registry. Let's talk about, you know, one person says, this is my land from this tree to this tree. I'm going to build a home on it. I'm going to do whatever I want. And at that point he leaves so that he can go get supplies so he can come back and build his home. Now, while he's gone, somebody else comes along and says, hey, this is a nice piece of property. I'm going to claim this as my land and I'm going to start building on it. And let's say he doesn't go to get supplies. He has already got supplies with him. So he just starts cutting down trees and building. At what point, you know, so the first guy comes back and says, wait, this is my land. You can't build on it. I already claimed it as mine. How is that type of dispute settled, or how could the first person reserve that land in, you know, in what you think things would look like?
Okay. So something that we need to unpack, an assumption built into your question, is this idea that land is so scarce that we actually need to be fighting over it, right? That we actually need to be trying to claim one another's living space because there isn't enough of it to actually go around. And the reason it appears to be that way, and we're fighting over resources in cities like rats, is because of the statist processes that substitute magic pieces of paper called land titles for the principle of just acquisition. So if this is the quantity of land, oh wait, that's, I don't want to show that on the screen. Okay, this square is the quantity of land in the world. This is the entire land surface of the earth.
Okay.
Okay. I need a tiny little piece of, I'm going to cut off a tiny little square, like a tiny little, this is the amount of land that's represented by land titles that the state has you fighting over. See the difference?
Yep.
So the idea that somebody in this tiny little square is going to fight you for your house, is going to try running into your house and try to steal it from you because you went to the store, is completely absurd and completely boxed in by the idea that this is all we have to work with. When we really have this.
Well, I think in general, you're right. But, you know, let's say, for example, there's, you know, in order to make your life easier, you need water to survive. You can either collect rainwater, which you're going to be dependent on rain, or you can pick land that's next to a stream where you can collect water from the stream. Now you can go anywhere in that big sheet of paper, you can go anywhere on that land and collect rainwater. But, if you want, you know, there will be more people who say, I'd rather live right next to the stream, and the amount of land that's next to a stream or a river is there's much less of it. And you know, you look at anything like whether there are natural resources, like people move to cities, usually looking for work or, you know, things like that. And these cities start popping up where there are resources. People kind of, they flood to these places where the resources are because that's where they want to be. That's like, nobody wants to live in the middle of the desert, or I don't want to say nobody, but most people don't want to live in the middle of the desert in the Texas heat.
I live in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, but that's, and that's you, and that's fine.
So I need to stop you there.
Okay.
The idea that humans are collecting themselves in tiny little dense inner cities because they want to be packed together and stacked on top of one another is proven false by the existence of the city of Phoenix. And I'll explain. So while an eastern city is often confined to a river valley, right, or a port area, right, and they didn't, of course, they grew up at a time when pedestrian traffic was more the norm, right, so they're densely populated. But in the West, where we were settled in a time when cars existed, for one, and the desert is a flat expanse of land. When people are free to build out, move separate from one another, and create plots of land that are large, of course, I we weren't 100% free, like that, you know, that Maricopa County divided those up like hundreds of years ago and decided how many plots there would be and how big they would be and all that, right? So just like, and of course it's colonized land, so it was never theirs to grant titles in the first place. But I digress. Let's just, I'm coming back to the idea that people do not choose to be cramped when they don't have to be. They do prefer to have a little bit of space in between them. And I mean, right, I don't know if you've ever seen Phoenix, but there's
always a reason. So like, so I grew up in Los Angeles, and there are a ton of people who move there, and now it's no longer for a natural resource. It's for a man-made resource of the entertainment industry. And people move there from all over the country, and they cram themselves into small expensive apartments to, you know, to try and be a part of the dream and make themselves a name in Hollywood. And a lot of people do this, and it's kind of, you know, they're not thinking about, you know, they're not thinking about like what you said, like, hey, I'd rather live in a place where I could be free and expand. They want to be a part of something. Oh, don't worry. My dogs will do that eventually too.
Nobbles always likes to make a cameo. So here's your cameo. Hi. All right. Okay. I'm sorry. Go on.
So people make that choice, and, you know, I agree in some places where, you know, like let's say you grow up in a city and you know your parents have always taught you like, oh yeah, you buy land in these little quadrants and that's just the way life is. There are those people, I agree with you, that they don't even have this concept of land outside of the city. But there are so many people that like they come from small towns. I met a guy from Worms, Nebraska, who moved to Los Angeles to be like Worms, Nebraska was a population of 16 and probably 10 miles. A little town, plenty of land, and he moved all the way to Los Angeles to get into showbiz, into this cramped little city. So people do that all the time, but the reality is, like, you can move like maybe 5 hours outside of Los Angeles and still have access to land. But if the business, the lifestyle that you want to be involved in is in that city, there's not free land inside of Los Angeles that you can move into and start claiming and developing or, you know, like that. It's basically so, already taken.
To me, it sounds like you're still arguing from scarcity and completely failing, or I should say neglecting to, I don't want to put negative words on you. Let's realize that an open voluntary marketplace exists that none of us can predict. So just because under modern state capitalism, we have these dense cities where scarcity is considered a norm and where people have to live on top of each other so they can fight for jobs underneath corporations, which is another form of scarcity. I don't see why we have to look to that paradigm for an example of the way property relations would look in a world set free, right? So, and I guess I come back to the sprawl of Phoenix in a certain sense, for another example, every time you know, develop like a, I can't think of the word, there's like a word for it.
Like
every time
neighborhood developments?
Every time another neighborhood happens, they just build another, you know, and I'm at this point, it's so formulaic. They need a grocery store, they need a convenience store, they need, you know, a hardware store. And it's the same, and I'm not saying I want a carbon copy world of corporate America, of course not. But what I'm saying is that when people choose to be in a place, then the services they need arise from their presence. So it's not going to be any different if you could choose from all of the land base that's available versus just the dense inner cities. However, I guess I didn't mean to derail that. I just wanted to then come back to your original question about the justice services and the idea of a registry and who decides how long your property can be abandoned before it can be used and occupied by another inhabitant. I think that was your original question.
Yeah.
Okay, so... the shortest answer is that coming back to the democratic principles, and these are, we could think, right libertarians, you think of a word like market forces, like the invisible hand, right? And left libertarians are going to freak out that I even went there, but whatever, just roll with it, right? We don't know what those processes are going to look like until we're free of the statist monopoly that currently controls what our lives look like and what form our justice has to take. We won't know until we laborious process of educating ordinary people about what a world set free can look like and principles that are involved in thinking about one, right? what it means to take responsibility for your own agency, your own autonomy, your self-determination, and everything that comes with that, right? What is the link between my property and my labor? Why is that considered a right? Why is it so important for me to be vigilant about that right? Right? So now let's say abolition happens. I don't know exactly what the what Justice Service people are going to choose, but I'm betting that once they have become educated about libertarian ideas, they're not going to choose to subscribe to a land registry service that drags away homeless people merely for laying there, right? I'm not going to subscribe to a police state service that I know is disproportionately harming Black and brown people, right? I'm not going to subscribe to white supremacy police state, right? Like, I just don't know exactly what it's going to look like. But I can tell you that we already have anarchy in most of our types of property. So if your property is not currently represented by a magic piece of paper, it is not protected by the state if it's under a certain view. And the default, what humans do in the absence of security and just monopoly, is a lot more like use and occupancy. So think about the way you treat, let's say, your laptop at a coffee shop. You know, depending how wealthy you are, they might protect your laptop, right? But mine's not protected. I have insurance for mine, right? But that doesn't mean I just leave it sitting around, because depending how long I walk away, right? Let's say I go to smoke a cigarette and someone, I don't smoke cigarettes, but just roll with it. You know, and I'm standing outside for 5 minutes. I think I'm going to be out there. And then someone walks by and that I know, and we start talking for 20 minutes. And I'm like, oh my God, I left my laptop inside. And somebody thought it was gone and used and occupied it, right? That happens. So guess what? I don't need my laptop sitting for 20 minutes at the coffee shop. I don't do that. I protect it myself, because I understand that the norms are that when property is abandoned, the longer it has been abandoned, the more likely it is for someone else to say, it doesn't look like anyone's using that. Now, I'm not saying it's okay to take my laptop. Of course not. And in most cases, someone would turn it into the lost and found before they just like took it. Anarchy in property. And that anarchy does not look like magic pieces of paper and artificial lines around every little thing on the planet.
Okay, that's I think that's pretty fair in that example. I just want to say real quick, it looks like Facebook is, I guess people are just getting audio and no video. So if you're, I'm going to be uploading this, so it will be available afterwards. I'm recording it here locally, so I'll be able to upload video, but I guess Facebook's just having some issues today. There's actually a question here.
I was never really connected that back to land. I don't know if you want to hear me.
I do, but I think, well, I get in my head, we talk about that, because I get in my head, I kind of already got what you were saying, and you know, maybe I'll say it and you'll say it wrong, but, but so, like, let's say, for example, if I build a house and I leave it, someone's going to see the house and they're going to say, oh, well, that's a house, it looks well taken care of, it's probably not abandoned, and, you know, because I was going to say, well, you know, if you leave your house for 5 minutes, obviously you can't pick it up and take it with you, but if you leave it there and, you know, but then if it looks like the walls are falling off of it, the roof is gone, the grass hasn't been mowed in 10 years, and someone might say, oh, this must be abandoned, and then they would go and just squat on it and, you know, see if anyone comes by, maybe, and if no one comes by for a few months, then just say, I'm just gonna take it over and make it mine. And I think even in the bottom right, I think that would kind of be acceptable, because, I mean, you have to look at, like, you might have, like, a totally abandoned ghost town where, you know, it's obvious he's living there, and, you know, I don't think there's an expectation that if you take that property, someone to come back and say, oh, well, I know I haven't lived there in forever, but this property was inherited to me by my great-grandfather, and it's mine, so you have to give me rent or something. I think that would be pretty ridiculous.
Well, I would think that, like, if that did happen, at the very least, the people in that geographic proximity would have already a set of established conflict resolution processes that they trust and that they can turn to, right? So whether that looks like my subscription to the, you know, my insurance that pays for a hotel till I find a new place. I mean, like, I don't know. I don't know what the Uber for land norms looks like.
Right.
Okay. But I know that it can exist.
And that's interesting that you, I mean, you call it the Uber of land norms. That's actually an interesting point, because there might be, you know, some service that pops up that says, you know, maybe it would be some sort of, like, map to abandon properties, where you abandon your property and you just say, here it is, go, you know, anyone who wants it can go take it.
Totally.
In exchange for doing that, the benefit to the person abandoning the property is that there's other properties that they can go take.
Totally. That is a great example.
I guess that's an interesting,
like an Airbnb timeshare. Oh, that's a really cool idea. Yeah. Somebody should, like, build that.
It's definitely cool, but it's Yeah, I guess one of the things that would be is you would have to assume that sorry, you wouldn't have to assume, but I would assume that in some system like that, the properties would probably be pretty run down because you wouldn't, like, let's say I had a property and it was, let's say it was a really nice house and I was going to abandon it and put it into this app for somebody else. Building this?
No, that is disproven by the way the rating system on eBay and Amazon and Yelp. The rating system. If you're not, first of all, when you're living in a place, typically you want that place to be habitable and you want it to be like it's your home, right? So, I mean, granted, we get comfortable in our homes and we deal with clutter that we don't want our guests to see because, you know, whatever. We lower our standards a little bit, right? But we don't, I mean, okay, some people do. But I guess, okay, so we can have examples. Let's look at Silence of the Lambs. The way he made his home, it's full of freaking moths, right? Mm-hmm. Private property didn't stop him from doing that, right? Because there are some people that don't care for things and there are some people that do.
I guess what I'm getting at is if I have a really nice house, I've been keeping really good care of it, and I want to abandon it, why would I abandon it as opposed to selling it? If you know, the chances of other people abandoning their properties might not look so nice. And, you know, you bring up the rating system, and that could be a thing where, okay, maybe you can only claim this abandoned property if you're a member of the system and you have some ratings or something, but then it becomes a closed system, which creates a system of scarcity.
I mean, I think I don't want to put a prescriptive answer on that. I feel like, but what resonates more with me are use and occupancy norms because they feel to me the most natural to the way that I have always guarded my own property and treated property that I, you know, like we find something that's just out of nowhere and there's no way to, that's an abandoned thing. And, you know, it's that you default to the sort of finders keepers thing, right? Conversely, if I find it in a coffee shop, right, then maybe I'm going to give it to them so they can place it in their lost and found, right?
So let's run with that for a little bit because, okay, so, you know, let's say somebody occupies the house and you leave for a couple of weeks, then, okay, it's fine. Like, you can trust that, okay, no reasonable person's going to say, well, I've seen this house empty for 2 weeks even though it looks well kept. I'm not going to assume it's abandoned. But what if it's something that's like a summer home where you go to it, you know, maybe once to assume that it's abandoned? What's to stop someone from trying to squat on it?
I think that one answer to that is that the time that's not being utilized, it could be utilized in the Uberized manner that we just discussed. So let's say that you're only there during the summer and it's a college town. Well, a student can live there during the winter, right? And we can use technology to figure that out much more easily. Another idea that I have is that if the people in this given vicinity, right, presumably there's this market for dispute resolution and the registry. So, you know, you report. I mean, like, I don't even leave my apartment for a weekend without making sure that I have someone checking in, you know, and just kind of keeping an eye. People, when you leave property, you would tend to come back to it. Like, we tend to take responsibility for that, right? So if you're leaving it, I presume, I've never had a summer house that I only go to once a year, but I presume that maybe you've got, you know, a cleaning service that goes in quarterly and just make sure that the dust is cleared. So it's, and I don't know, right? But I feel like, what was the original question?
Well, I guess, I'm not even really sure. I guess kind of what I'm trying to see is, because from the bottom, let's say, there's kind of the fear that that what the bottom left would do is just say, like, I'm going to assume that since there's nobody in this house that, you know, nobody's been in this house all winter, I'm going to occupy it. And if anybody ever you know, comes to say, hey, this is my house, you shouldn't be in here, then they're going to have a problem kicking them out. Or even the fact that because it's not, like, you know, if it's done with an Airbnb service, right, you're renting, you can look at the reviews, you know that the people going in there might have good reviews. But even with that, I know some people who rent with Airbnb. I hear stories about, like, people leave and they take TV or they take the silverware and there's nothing they can do about it. Airbnb doesn't help them recover anything. There's no deposits.
Okay, but magic uses of state paper are already not protecting you from that. And I have news for you. Anybody told you anarchism was a utopia, they lied. Anarchy can't stop that any more than magic pieces of state paper.
Right, I'm not arguing that it should. I guess what I'm more interested in is what type of people are the bottom left are they going to be a problem where we have, where, you know, this is going to be a problem where they're going to start taking property like that?
So the bottom left, the entire motivation behind wanting to live in a world where scarcity is not artificially enforced is so that we no longer are forced to compete over scarce resources for the benefit of few politically connected, of the ruling class, right? The idea is not so that we can, get rid of the ruling class and keep fighting over the scraps. That is just absurd. You know, flourish instead of just merely survive. That is the promise of a world set free. It's not a world where prosperity is restricted even further, or where we continue to live within the boundaries of constricted prosperity. Oh, like, poof, magic, the ruling class went away, but we just keep fighting over, you know, their little mad piece of paper. No, no. We're going to expand out into a beautiful vista that is liberty and actually live. That's what's going to happen.
Okay, interesting. And yeah, I think to kind of go back to what you said a minute ago, like, there's the fact that the bottom left is interested in getting rid of government and the bottom right is also, I kind of look at it like this, like, because I know some of my followers that mostly stick to the right, they've even accused me of going left now, for even having a civil conversation with people from the left. But it's what's interesting is that if both of us get what we want and the government goes away, it's so let's say me and my ANCAP friends, we all get rid of government, we succeed. The bottom left is still there, and the things that you're the ways that you're envisioning the future, you're envisioning it without government. So the reality is, whether we partner with you or not, government's going away. And whether we partner with you or not, when government goes away, we're still all living in the same world together, and we're going to have to deal with our differences on some level. So it's I think that's a really interesting point, because it's not like, I guess that most of the people on the right, bottom or top right, are, you know, they're afraid of socialism, as we're going to steal your money to pay for healthcare programs. And that's not really what the libertarian socialist is about.
That's what socialism.
Right. So that's really not an issue. We're talking about stealing to pay for. We're talking about living. You know, I guess, as you said, not fighting over the scraps that are left over from the system that only give us access to the scraps.
Exactly.
Okay, I think that's I think that's pretty fair. And I think, you know, for the most part, in talking to you and Dane and some of the other libstocks, it's, you know, I don't have this feeling like, you know, like my lifestyle is gonna be at risk, like, you know, government's gonna go away and then you guys are all gonna turn to pirates and go around robbing everybody. That's, you know, I think that's, you know, what's interesting is, like, it's the boogeyman theory. Like, everybody, you know, whether it's they want to control someone and you know, create a fight between them, they make the other person look like the boogeyman, or to some people it's from people they don't understand, they kind of turn into the boogeyman themselves. But I think what's really important is to understand is that a statist, whether from the left or the right, a statist wants to use force to force you to live the way he wants to live. But an anarchist, whether from the left or the right, do not want you to be forced to live the way that they want to live at all.
Right. And I think that is really, if I could just get one thing across about the radical left, is that it's just like another radical narrative that we would be familiar with, one that's very staunchly anti-statist, and one that is vigilant toward authoritarian narratives, right? We already know what it's like in the LP when statist politicians try to pander and they try to steal back the votes that they think they're entitled to, and they try to lean and make themselves look libertarian, but they aren't really. We know what it means to push back, to be on guard for that, and to make sure that the clarity of our vision is maintained, right? And the same is true of radical anarchists. The different semantics, right? And there's different sort of lenses through which the vision is expressed, right? But ultimately, a world set free is a world free of coercive institutions. And what's like, and what's happening across the bottom is everybody's just trying to paint picture of what that looks like to them, right? And we get really excited about it. And then, you know, when people are excited, they start talking past each other, right? And it starts to play conflict. And of course, all of this is happening in polarized dialogue, right? So, like, that talk also has a study that everyone on the bottom is trying to push back so that we can, you know, maintain integrity of our vision. And I'm sorry, one thing I want to cross is that those are not so disparate that, okay, the essence of coercion is what it is, right? And so that is something that, you know, I feel it'd be very unifying, right? But we have to want it. We have to want unity with one another and freedom from all the coercive institutions more than we like fighting each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, the government thrives on us fighting each other. I think in every aspect. I'm wondering, have you, I'm sure you have, the it's like 10 question political quiz, where I think libertarian is at the top, authoritarian is at the bottom, and then I remember what the sides, I think the sides are just, I think they just say left or right. Where do you fall on that?
So I'm at the tip of that, right? So anarchism is anarchism, so you're 100% free, personally, and economically. I like that chart for outreach to status. And the reason why I like that chart for outreach to status is, for one, it's very simple. It's very easy. It's ideal for an outreach tool. It asks questions through the lens of mainstream politics, which is personal freedom and economic freedom.
Right.
Right. So that's great. It's ideal that it is. But it's not so ideal for is the nuance behind economic freedom, right? It's possible to envision, there's a lot of different ways of thinking about the workplace could be structured, right? Whether it's worker ownership or whether it's boss, you know, employee hierarchical, right? There's different ways to think about land, whether it's used in occupancy or whether it's, whether it's based on the idea of commons, right? Or whether a person, there's different ideas, right? And so that is what Square chart gives us, right? So instead of having economic, I'll switch to a little tippy tip so that like me and ANCAP look identical. So I do, that's an argument in favor of that, but we're more identical, we think, right?
Right.
But on the square, right, we have, so instead of being squished into that tip, where now we have a scale that represents those different ideas. So what you try to tell people is that tippy tip square is the bottom hole zero line, right? So if you want to be 100% free, you will be anywhere along that bottom edge, right? That's the zero tippy tip.
Okay.
And then, you know, there's degrees of statism and get a little bit more, you know, it's this, yeah, the scale on that chart is me, so.
And I think that's actually a really important point. So on that, you know, on that flat line of freedom, we may fall on opposite ends of it, but at the end of the day, like right now, our main issue is that there's this big government beast that we're, I mean, that's why anyone's involved in the Libertarian Party. That's kind of the purpose of the party is to shrink the size of government and for some to completely get rid of it. And so because we're that's the game that we're fighting. And so that chart, you know, like you said, is statist oriented. In that game of fighting big government, we're all on the same team. So I think that's a really important argument for Bonamici. And you know, and once it's done, and you know, here's the other thing, like, you know, this spectrum of when I talked to Dean, like most of the things he said were that, you know, the way he wanted to live his life was he wanted to spend his energy, his own personal energy, to voluntarily take care of other people and help people in need. And that's commendable. And I didn't feel like he was going to be taking any from me in order to do that. So really what it sounds like is, you know, everybody's got different interests. Some people want to be doctors so they can help people. Some people want to be athletes because they just like the game. Some people want to be philosophers. Like, whatever your life choice is of what you want to do with your existence, nobody wants to spend it on people. Whatever you want to do with your life, is it'll be different for everybody. And I think as long as that doesn't interfere with other people, that's fine. And for some people, they want to create, produce, and make big things, and maybe want to participate in some sort of tracking system of, you know, money to keep track of how much you produce to exchange with others. And if you want to, that's your right to do that. And at the same time, if you don't want to participate in that at all, and you want to participate in taking care of people and social issues, you know, it's really your own. It's your personal preference of what you want to do with your life. But at the same time, like, together we can at least say, but nobody should be telling us which of those we should be doing.
Right. And, you know, I might even add that I think there are ways that the different anarchist sort of rhetorical frames can benefit one another, right? So if I'm a right libertarian and trying to tell people that private charity can be our safety net, the modern non-profit industrial complex is a form of artificially imposed scarcity, right? It's basically capitalism in the non-profit sector, and it prohibits a wide variety of mutual aid activities, and it also creates top-down structures where resources are... But anyway, I'm off my point. The mutual aid aim talking about a voluntary safety net is a really powerful one, and I think that it can help shift that dialogue and give people a sense that mutual aid networks can actually be resilient enough to meet people's needs that aren't met through any other type of economic activity. And I'm trying to think of a parallel example from the other direction, and what's coming most to mind is the way that, you know, so with sex work, sometimes when it's too social justice oriented, it can veer off into where there's a vulnerability where, like, oh, women are just being exploited, or, you know, trans women are being exploited. And when you're able to set that back with a stronger economic lens, where we are able to say, no, sex work is work, and this is a means of production that is unto my own self-ownership, then I can benefit from, you know, the economic language of the right, right? So I think that being able to navigate conversations with a broader range of vocabulary actually strengthens us. And I'm really excited to see what it looks like.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point. And there's something else I want to point out, and I know we're not enemies by any degree of the word, but I know, you know, some people are, they're afraid they've got boogeyman syndrome. But I just want to say, like, even if you're afraid that, you know, the bottom left or the bottom right is your enemy, just think about this for a minute. Right now, your real enemy is the government. The government is the one that steals from you every day. The government is the one pointing a gun at you every day. And at the very least, they get through that first. and then we can kind of work out our differences afterwards, if there are any to work out. Because I mean, honestly, you know, like I said, I don't consider you an enemy. And as much as I'm trying to dig at it and get you to say something that, you know, that's gonna be like you're gonna steal my property, or it's like it's not there. And so I really don't think anyone would be afraid of that. I think that's I think that's, you know, the boogeyman. Anyway, is there anything before we go that you want to mention? Any websites, any causes you're working with, the maybe the Libertarian Socialist website, Facebook page, anything?
Well, I do want to ask you to follow my personal advocacy page, which is My Shipley, Libertarian. So just look that up. Sometimes when so the thing with caucus organizing is that we become perceived as a base for that caucus, and then that can make it difficult to push boundaries in other ways. So sometimes I use my personal page for that. So see like my most authentic individual opinion on that page. And as far as the Libertarian Socialist Caucus, just facebook.com/libsoc. I say libsoc, but just for clarity, libsoc, L-B-S-O-C, caucus, C-A-U-C-U-S. The Audacious Caucus is on Facebook as well. So is the Povertarian Caucus. So is that right, Libertarians? I mean, you just search for names and you find them. Most of them also have groups. Actually, they all have groups. So the page is where we put out information to the followers. That's when you click like. And then there's also a group, which is where we can collaborate with one another. So if you want to be actively involved, join the group as well. If you just want to follow along and maybe interact with the content like in the comments, go ahead and like and follow the pages. And all of those projects have Twitters as well. I probably, you know what I will do is I will put together a post with all of the different links in it, and I'll post that to my page in about 20 minutes.
Cool. And actually, if you want to see that, I'll post it next to the video also.
Cool.
Something else you just said that's actually really interesting that I want to dwell on for a minute. Is you said that, you know, most of the things that you say when you push the boundaries, you say them from your personal page rather than from the caucus page. And I think that's a really interesting point, because like I struggle with this all the time, because I'm running a campaign and I'm involved with the Libertarian Party, and so everybody always comes to me like, I got accused of being a racist today who hates minorities and the poor, because that was this person's presumption of what a libertarian was, because they probably heard, you know, one libertarian say something like that. And we need to get out of this, like, this groupthink mentality of, you know, there are Democrats who are good people and who wouldn't support any of the crap that's on the Democrat platform. Same with Republicans. Just because somebody's in a group, does, you know, if they say something really good or really bad, it does not necessarily speak directly for that group. Like, a group itself has no mind. It's a collection of 1,000 people with different minds, and if they're not all the same people, that never happens. Like, it's, I've never been in a room with more than 5 people. I've never been in a room with more than 2 people that all thought the same. So that's just the thought there with that. But Mike, it's been great talking with you. I think we got through a lot of interesting points. And hopefully change some people's minds about how they see the other side of the bottom. And it's been great, and we'll talk again soon.
Awesome. Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it as well.
All right, and taxation is theft.
Taxation is certainly theft.